Listeners, hello and welcome to the 240th edition of Sudbury News Talk magazine. I do hope you're well, and isn't it lovely to feel the days brightening and hear the birds getting busy again. When planning ahead for this year's magazines, 240 felt like it should be a significant number. Putting my maths head on, I realised that it is quite significant, as it represents our 40th anniversary. Now, I don't know what date the very first magazine recording was made, but that may not matter, as we'll hear later. Of course, much has changed over the last 40 years, at Sudbury News Talk as elsewhere, but one thing that hasn't changed is that everybody has an interesting story to tell, and the magazine is very dependent on teamwork. Some members travel from outlying villages just to do a 5-minute slot, which says a lot for their dedication. That was a quote from an article in the Suffolk Free Press in 1993, which holds just as true today. It came from Kate Osborne, a magazine volunteer whose 100th birthday celebrations were marked in an item written by Nadine and Rita for the 210th edition almost exactly 5 years ago. Our first item today is by Julie Thompson to tell us about some very special anniversary gifts.
Spoiler alert, you might need a tissue just before the end of this piece, but I hope that a true story, straight from the heart, might make a bit of a change on this special News Talk anniversary edition. My parents, David and Margaret, married in 1968 on the 30th of March. I understand that was a good date to tie the knot, and many people did, as there was a tax advantage to getting married before the new financial year. I bet there are a few listeners who did the same. They started their life together in North London before trying to get away from the crowded living conditions and pollution that was so detrimental to my mum's health condition. As my father's family were originally from Suffolk, it was a dream come true when he was offered a job with the Water Board with a new 3-bedroom council house. So they moved to Suffolk at the beginning of the 70s, the perfect place to start their family of two. Yep, me, and 18 months later, my sister Claire came onto the scene. It's funny, I always remember giving them a wedding anniversary card, which is odd, because of course I wasn't at their wedding. But I guess it just became a thing. Starting with those homemade ones with the terrible crayon drawings, right up to the big over-the-top ones with the cushioned fronts that were all the rage in the 1980s. But why am I telling you this? Well, when I heard that this year was the 40th anniversary of Sudbury News Talk, this is what came to mind. Let's rewind to 2008, to a time before I joined Facebook and I still had a full-time job. It was my parents' 40th wedding anniversary, and as my sister had emigrated to Australia 4 years earlier, it was down to me to make it a bit of a fuss, a bit more fuss than the usual card anyway. What to get them was the question, as buying an actual ruby was beyond my purse. I drew a blank, but then it came to me. That lovely old book that Arthur gave me, the Cockney Rhyming Slam book. I needed to double check that I had remembered correctly, and a quick look revealed that I had. A Ruby Murray is a curry, and apparently it refers to the name of a singer from the 1950s. With that as inspiration, I went along to Raffy's Spice Box in Sudbury and purchased a wicker hamper filled with 40 bags of different Indian spices, gift wrapped with a ruby red ribbon and a Raffy signed copy of her recipe book congratulating them on this momentous occasion. The special day arrived and I went to visit them, and I gave them my proud gift, and they were very pleased to receive it. Although, I think Dad preferred the gold watch with the inset ruby Mum had brought him, and she adored the ruby earrings with matching necklace from him. It's tissue time. Mum died in 2020. Dad moved into a care home last month. And as my sister is still in Australia, it fell to me to clear the house. One day a week I visit and sort through what's left of their memories. A hugely emotional and conflicted task. I can't keep everything. I can't keep most of it. There's only so much room in Dad's wardrobe at the care home. But there are so many things that accompany us through our lives. Possessions that give us comfort. Memories wrapped up in old toys, books, and the treasured items we inherit from those that have gone before and that we can't bear to part with. Turns out that my mum kept every card that she and Dad had ever been sent. Every birthday, Mother's and Father's Days, get well soon, sorry you're leaving, and thank you cards. I've had to throw them all away. There are four large boxes of photographs and a suitcase with all the memorabilia from their wedding day. What on earth am I meant to do with these? Last week, at the back of the understairs cupboard, behind the chest freezer, and resting on top of a redundant gas fire that should have been taken to the tip 30 years ago, I found a dust-covered wicker hamper. I opened it, and inside was a ruby red ribbon and 40 packets of unopened Indian spices and an autographed book from Raffi's Spice Box in Sudbury. Tissues away. To try to end this piece on an upbeat note, Mum and Dad celebrated their 50th golden wedding anniversary in 2018, and this time I got it just right. I booked them a surprise afternoon tea at the Angel Hotel in Bury St Edmunds. I arranged for the table in the window to be decorated, and they were so happy. We had a view overlooking the entrance to the Abbey Gardens, and I'd brought them a small painting in a gold frame of Angel Hill, with the hotel and the very window we were sat in shown in the picture. They said that they had walked past this hotel hundreds of times, but had never dreamt that one day they'd be able to go inside, let alone have afternoon tea there. Ruby memories.
Thank you, Julie, for sharing that really nice story. And even though the ruby wedding gift wasn't perhaps to your parents' taste, they really treasured the thought, obviously, and you hit the nail right on the head 10 years later for their 50th. Our next item comes from Ken Watkins and involves sudden events and anniversary celebrations spanning three generations.
Our daughter and son-in-law celebrated their 20th wedding anniversary recently, and I'll admit that until my wife reminded me, I didn't think they'd been married that long. Add in the fact that they'd lived together for a few years before getting married, and suddenly I felt quite old, which of course I am. Sue and Nathan got married in the British Virgin Islands, which is where my son-in-law was born. They'd met at Uplands Middle School in Sudbury, so I suppose we could describe them as childhood sweethearts. A few years after leaving school, Nathan was offered a post at a resort in the Virgin Islands and moved out there a couple of months before Sue followed him. She was also offered employment there, but there was a slight snag. The British Virgin Islands government only allowed BVI passport holders to take up jobs. Nathan had one by right. Sue could only obtain one by marrying a BVI passport holder. It was, you could say, the BVI government's version of a shotgun wedding. We had a phone call letting us know that they were planning to get married in just a few weeks on a beach in the Caribbean. I guess we should have expected it. After all, we'd been telling them for years not to worry about us, but to just elope. For various reasons, we couldn't go to the wedding, with a disabled son and my elderly mother-in-law living with us, plus the fact that we'd let our passports lapse, travelling any distance, even in the UK, was not easily achievable. While it was disappointing that we couldn't go, we were there in spirit. And on the day, Nathan's grandparents, who lived in Long Melford, joined us for lunch, along with my sister-in-law Mary and her three children who came up to Elfeaton from Eastbourne. The 10 of us FaceTimed with Sue and Nathan on the day. We got photographs of the ceremony soon after and a video a few weeks later. Family wedding anniversaries are always important, and our family is no different. We celebrated my parents' Ruby wedding in 1970, and that's really the first big event I could properly share with them. My parents had been married 13 years before I was born, so their silver wedding came and went, not without me noticing, but with a little less involvement than had I been a few years older. But at 12, perhaps the significance doesn't register quite as much as later in life. Their golden wedding in 1980 was just a little bit different, with me making the main speech as their best man from 50 years earlier, Mum's brother Ted, had emigrated to Australia after retiring. Judy and I had been married 3 years when Mum and Dad reached their 40th. Their anniversary was June the 28th and ours June the 24th, so it was never hard for either of us to remember, and we always got together as near to those dates as possible to enjoy a meal out. For their 40th, Judy organised red roses, and the celebratory meal was shared by other relatives as the family and friends got together. Being with Mum and Dad was a tradition we continued for several years. Judy and I would travel to Coventry for a few days to stay with Alice and George, and initially just the four of us would enjoy a meal out, usually at a place called the Chase Hotel in the city. I hadn't been there for several years, so while writing this talk I looked it up online and found that, sadly, it closed after the COVID epidemic. When our children came along, we switched to somewhere less formal, just a short distance from where my parents lived, and which catered more easily, initially, for a baby and toddler, and still managed to look after us as the children grew. Newstalk started 40 years ago in 1985, and that was also a year which proved very significant for our family, but one of mixed memories. Sadly, Mum died in March that year, and a few weeks later, I was offered the post of editor of the Suffolk Free Press. Bittersweet. I'd had a first interview for the post before Mum's health really deteriorated, so she knew that I was on the shortlist. My dad always said, "Don't regret what you can't change," advice I've generally tried to follow, but I really have loved to have been able to tell Mum I got the job. I was editor for 4 years before leaving to work in Colchester and then London, but returned to the Suffolk Free Press 11 years later as sports editor. Little did I know, at the time we moved to Suffolk in 1985, I would be living there for 35 years, first in Acton and then Elfeaton. But that's another story.
Thank you, Ken. I was struck listening to your piece by the togetherness that your family seem to enjoy, from the two centre wedding in British Virgin Islands and Long Melford to the anniversary celebrations in Coventry. Let's hear now from Margaret King with her story of intertwining anniversaries.
I have written the following article with the full permission of my friend Linda, who also helped by supplying the names of relevant places which I had forgotten. Ruby, 40th anniversaries and other celebrations. It was a sunny day, if a little breezy. Saturday, March the 25th, 1967. Easter Saturday, an early one that year. We were travelling down to Crawley, a new town at that time in Sussex. We were both dressed in our best attire. I was wearing a new dress which I had made, all bright psychedelic colours, and a coat in lime green, the very hottest spring fashion. After all, this was 1967, and the summer of love would dawn shortly. Hippies, flower power, and San Francisco reigned supreme. We were very excited with anticipation, looking forward to being at the wedding of one of my best college friends, Linda, and her husband-to-be, Robin. Both had been teenage sweethearts since meeting at secondary school some years previously. As we reached our destination, pumping out from the car radio was the Rolling Stones' latest offering, an easy song to sing along to.
Goodbye, Ruby Tuesday, who can hang a name on you? When you change with every new day, still I'm gonna miss you.
The lyrics were synonymous with the mood of the time, synonymous also for us with memories of that special day. St. Mary's Church, a modern red-bricked building, hosted the service. All went well. The weather stayed fine for the ensuing photographs. Then we all travelled on to the reception at the Black Dog Public House. Robin's best man, a young work colleague called Les, was, admittedly, very nervous. However, he managed to deliver a very reasonable speech. Only the main players had noticed that Les had a hip flask from which he was drinking copiously. The first sign of him being completely out of control came when, approaching a middle-aged aunt, he swept her backwards in a massive clinch, unceremoniously knocking her hat off. Somewhat ridiculously, Robin decided to motor Les back to his parents' house to put him to bed. Forgetting the house keys, Rob then climbed up a pole, onto the porch, through an open window, and finally down the stairs to let him in. The bed idea was distinctly unreliable, as Les kept falling out. So much so that when Rob's uncle, an East Ender born and bred, arrived on the scene and inquired in the broadest of Cockney accents, with fists at the ready, whether he should doff him up, things took a ludicrous turn. Suffice to say that details of the best man's departure are lost in the mist of time, but neither Robin or Linda ever saw him or heard from him again. I guess he was just so ashamed of his behaviour. 17 months later, Linda and Robin attended our wedding, August the 17th, 1968. Back to Ruby and the 40th anniversary of their wedding, this time held in Great Ballard School near Chichester, in the impressive dining room. March the 25th, 2007, was a Sunday, the day after the clocks went forward. Determined to avoid the perennial jokes about their penchant for always being late, the slogan, "Waiting for the Waits," a pun on their surnames, was often spoken. Linda and Rob booked a taxi to the venue, only to find that the driver had forgotten all about the time change, so they were late once again. But 40 years on, what a special anniversary, a gathering of family and friends, the grown-up son and daughter, plus the first granddaughter. Three more granddaughters were to follow in the future. Two-year-old Poppy, appropriately dressed in a pretty Poppy outfit. 17 months later, Linda and Robin attended our Ruby wedding anniversary, August the 17th, 2008. Fast forward 10 years, and it is March the 25th, 2017. Lynn and Robin's 50th anniversary, their golden wedding, this time held in the Well Diggers, a public house in a beautiful setting, its gardens overlooking the South Downs. No mishaps this time, a gathering of family and friends, meeting and greeting, many friends long unseen, everyone much older. Sadly, we were all very aware of Robin's illness, which was terminal, although during that memorable afternoon, no stranger ever would have guessed. He was the life and soul of the party, as they say, and I shall always remember him amusing his four young granddaughters and everyone else by swinging, monkey style, on a sturdy bough in the pub's garden. Oh, if only we could turn back time and flash back to hearing once again the Stones belting out Goodbye, Ruby Tuesday. 17 months later, Linda came to our golden wedding anniversary, August the 17th, 2018, Robin having died just 11 months before.
Thank you, Margaret. Well, weddings are supposed to be high drama, and I think that article was also high drama. We really enjoyed the duet in the middle there. But how lovely that you, John, Linda and Robin were all such good friends all through those golden years. And isn't music such a strong accompaniment to memory? I will remember that one for a while. And it may be that our listeners can hear some angelic singing in the background. We have the lovely choir next door. So we can hear them probably a bit more loudly than you can. But I hope it's not spoiling it for you. So here we are onto the quiz. And we have a mini quiz today, just to be different. And the first question is, which band sang The Sound of Silence? Question two. What is the first consonant in the English alphabet? Question three. Which I've lost. After whom were teddy bears named? Question four. Which colour is called jaune in French? And question five. Who was known as the pelvis? And we'll be back with the answers a bit later. And now for something almost totally different. Here's Richard Fawcett with another of his pertinent questions, if I may be so impertinent.
Slippery things, anniversaries. Unlike birthdays, which typically nowadays come with certificates and which we call birthdays. So what about Christmas? Even without a birth certificate, we sing Hodie Christus Natus Est, Christ is born today, and we all agree on the 25th of December. It's been so, apparently, since the time of Constantine, when ancient Rome adopted Christianity. However, some studies of stars, which might be the Bethlehem star, lead to a belief that Jesus was born, yes, on the 25th of December, but in 3 BC, Christ born before Christ. And the tricky old Romans tracked years in different ways, sometimes, for instance, counting ab urbe condita from the founding of the city, traditionally on the 21st of April 753 BC. But it seems most scholars and ancient historians prefer a date around 6 to 4 BC, not, of course, 4 to 6 BC, And for many believers, Easter is more important in the life of Christ. But there is no set date for Easter. A simple guide is the first Sunday after the full moon occurring on or after the spring equinox. But that involves astronomy, and astronomy does my head in. Three dimensions are already enough for me. A more straightforward anniversary is Armistice Day, 11th of November, the end of hostilities in the 1914-18 war. Oh, but we also speak of Remembrance Sunday, not always the same thing. And for the entire nation to stand in silent remembrance at the same moment requires uniform time across the land, which was not so until 1840 to meet the timetabling needs of the railways. In good time for the war, however. But we can be confident that the actual day the war ended in 1918 was marked all across the battlefields, at least on the Western Front. Can't we? As Siegfried Sassoon, no stranger to the war, writes, everyone suddenly burst out singing. However, Australian private soldier Edward Lynch, in his memoir Some Mud, relates his experience of the armistice as follows, and I summarise. 8th of November. The battalion at rest is due back into the front line. That night, the move is postponed 24 hours. 9th of November. The move to the front is postponed a further 18 hours. 10th of November. Rumours of peace and the abdication of the Kaiser. 11th of November, word comes the Australians are to entrain for the front early morning on the 12th of November. French citizens are celebrating wildly. Fini la guerre, monsieur! The CO tells his troops he has a message that hostilities ceased at 11 that morning. Ah, but the message is unofficial. 12th of November at 4 a.m., they march off to Ailly-sur-Somme, where the train waits. It will wait until 12. Two boys come onto the platform with Paris editions of the London papers for sale. Delirious joy all along the train as the papers are bought and read. Remarks one Australian, if the news of this armistice was all over the world yesterday morning, it's flaming queer that a battalion only 50 miles from the front line couldn't have been officially advised. Oh, is it really so odd?
Thank you, Richard. As ever, things are a lot more complicated than you think they should be. It's so much simpler in the fairy stories when you can rely on a year and a day later. And another thing, how do people feel about anniversaries when the calendar jumped by 11 days from the Julian to the Gregorian, if I've got that round the right way? Now, I have an admission to make. Jackie McSweeney's first contribution to the magazine in July last year was followed in September by her first magazine contribution. I mixed up the recordings and we never got to hear the intended item until now. As Jackie can't be here today, here's something she prepared a lot earlier.
Hello everyone. I assume you must have enjoyed my first talk as I'm back for a second. You are gluttons for punishment. This month, there are so many topics I could choose that reflect our wonderful town, but I've decided to focus on the key, our local theatre. tucked down the bottom of Key Lane, is Sudbury's little gem of a theatre. With a very long history, the Key is situated on the River Stour, nestled between the rowing club, the tennis club, the granary, the bowls club, and a few yards from the cricket ground. The Key offers a huge variety of entertainment, every age catered for, from a youth theatre to an old-time musical coming up, which should spark some of the old grey cells with a good old sing-song. As I creep towards retirement, I'm expanding my interests, and as you may be able to tell from my voice, I like a bit of fun. So I started to volunteer at the Key in May. I had trod the boards in my youth, some ballet, and later in my working career, a few hospital reviews, so gadding about a theatre had always appealed to me. And what a delightfully fulfilling role this is turning out to be. I started with a tour. The Key is quite a TARDIS, you know. Lots of spaces for future opportunities. The auditorium holds 125 seats, less on a screening night, or if the performers want to step off the stage into the audience. Indeed, many of the tribute bands I've seen did this, which was really engaging the audience and had people dancing in the aisles. Comfy seats, aircon or heating to suit, a well-stocked bar provides a mix of refreshments for all tastes, all of which can be pre-ordered to avoid the interval rush and adds up to an enjoyable evening out. You can even park for free in its car park. Once I'd received my official Key polo shirt, I felt part of the fabulous team of volunteers and staff. I volunteered in the box office, taking orders for shows and topping up leaflets and posters. The front of house, ushering people to their seats and providing help and support, and a safety net in the event of fire. I'm soon to venture into the bar and return again to my youth, pulling pints and dancing up and down the optics. Whilst doing my stint in the front of house, I get to see the range of shows the Key offers. Dramatic plays, ballets, comedy nights, films, live music and tribute bands. Some celebrities like Griff Rhys-Jones and Mark Steele's coming soon. I bet he's a sellout. You will all have your preferred genre, I'm sure. Possibly my favourite to watch are the live streams from the National Theatre. The joy of watching world-class actors up close, surrounded by a real audience, laughing, gasping and applauding is fabulous. Better than being there, I think, as you can see right into the actor's eyes, see and hear their emotions, and the big screen emphasises the skill and experience of the actors. All this, and without the hassle of travelling to London. We can sometimes forget the benefits of a shared experience, that emotional response you feel deep in the pit of your stomach, or the flutter of your heart singing. Seeing the splendour of the people on the stage and hearing the enjoyment of the audience is good for us. I don't think I've seen a performance that hasn't given me something to say. So it's not just about the production, it's about the reflections and reliving the experience by explaining it to others that make it whole. So I urge you to come along, immerse yourself in something you love, or challenge yourself with something you're not sure about. Either way, love it or hate it, it will give you something to talk about and a special memory. The Key is such a treasure. It's our wonderful theatre in our gorgeous town of Sudbury. Unique, quirky, friendly and entertaining. So, Key into the Key. The Key to your entertainment. I hope to see you there soon.
Thank you, Jackie. I'm constantly surprised and impressed by how much is going on in Sudbury in general and at places like the Key in particular. As you say, something for everyone in a truly fabulous setting. John King is here now, using his mind's eye to paint us a picture of Sudbury of old, as it was then.
Yes, as it was said, as it was then, is the title of this piece. And it may be very tearful to those people, very few people, who are old enough to actually remember any of it. And it may be informative to those who are not. The gas mantle gently increased its glow and thus cast its strange light into the room. It did not, of course, manage to light the far end of the room very well. This was Granny and Granddad's house in Gainsborough Street, 1944. The living room with the gas was situated directly behind the grocer's shop, greengrocer's actually, known as C.D. King's, Seedsman and Greengrocers. Naturally, the shop was lit by gas, essential on late afternoons of winter. There was no heating in the shop, so at times it was absolutely freezing. However, it may interest you to know that Grandad and Granny listened to the radio. How was that? Even though there being no electricity, and certainly no trannies. Well, they had a radio that ran on high-tension dry cell battery and rechargeable wet cell accumulator. There must have been many people with this setup, as radio supply in North Street, now Lipstick and Locks, employed a man with a van to collect spent accumulators and deliver recharged ones. I'm told that the walls of the cellar of the said building still show the effects of the gases released during the charging process. We lived two doors down and we did have mains electricity. I used to go to Nanny's most weekday evenings, which could be reached by a back route through the gardens. But in the winter, this was too dark and scary, so I would go via the street. This was also pitch black on moonless winter nights, as it was wartime blackout in force, so no street lighting. No one was scared of strangers, as basically there were none. Yes, there were local strange people, but they were all known. I would feel my way down the street by walking sideways when we're back to the wall and counting the windows and doors until I knew that I was at the shop. Whereupon I opened the door and a bell on a piece of spring steel would clang. People in general did not lock their doors until bedtime, if then. There was a very little traffic as private car fuel was unavailable, and even if it had been, few people could afford cars. We had one that belonged to my other granddad. It was jacked up on blocks to preserve the tyres. Dad had a treasured can of petrol from before restrictions. About three times a year, he would use a little of this fuel just to start the engine to stop it from seizing up. I was too young to know how he did this, but I think he put fuel directly into the carburetor, a fire hazard if not knowing what you're doing. The reason for a little fear of crime was, of course, linked to the lack of mobility. Traffic was so light that for long periods there was none at all. Shops were all specialised, as there were, of course, no superstores. We had several greengrocers, I recall King's, Watson's, Lefley's, Boast's, and one in Station Road may have been called Peasman's, but I'm not sure. Similarly, grocers, again, King's, distinctly related to the greengrocer, Walker Stores, International Stores, Commons and Holland and Barrett. I could continue with butchers, fishmongers, sweet shops, clothes, etc. The main point was that they all had limited stocks to sell, or in the case of sweet shops, nothing at all. Goods were rationed, a system that did not completely end until 1954. The sweet shops were shut, the windows decorated with tantalising pre-war empty chocolate boxes. I had never seen chocolates or ice cream or cream biscuits. In the early 1943, it had been noticed that there was a change afoot, because there was more traffic and people about the lorries carrying sand and gravel. I learned later they were building the airdrome in Warningfield. We still have the gravel pits to remind us. The airfield opened in April 1944, the same time as my first day at school. Many Americans were stationed there and a lot lost their lives. I remember the flares being fired into the air after the planes returned from sorties. They were red, green and white. I think they were signals to the emergency service for requirements of help and being signalled by the colours. A little later, British troops were moved into the area. We had several sleeping in our front room. They had a cookhouse in Gregory Street. I know also that at one point our house was full of weapons. Troops were not in Sudbury for many weeks, for one day tanks and trucks and other military vehicles started rumbling down the street past our house. It went on for most of the day. I knew later that all of this kit and people were heading for South Coast. D-Day was in the offing and troops were gone. I wonder, did they survive that terror? Sudbury was involved in the war effort with silk manufacturing for chutes, military clothing and, of course, the airfield. When VE Day came, I remember bunting across every street. I went that day with my Uncle Percy up to the fields and nursery, standing in the back of a locked truck, holding on to the ladder rack. Imagine that now. The feeling was wonderful, but I did not really understand why. There was no return to land of plenty. That took a long time. Films depicting life in the USA with everything about them and flashy cars were like dreamland. European food production had been devastated by the war and countries were bankrupt and in debt. Primarily, people had to be fed the basics and prevented from hunger. Little did we know the shops full of temptation will lead to problems we now have with an overweight population caused by the lifting of controls.
Thank you, John. Your stories are always so vivid and atmospheric. I almost feel I'm there too, walking crabwise along Gainsborough Street in the dark. What a different place Sudbury was at that time. I'm really pleased now to be able to introduce a new contributor, Margaret Hibble, with some Sudbury memories of her own. Margaret Hibble can't be with us today, so Margaret King will read for her.
Do you remember? As this is my first contribution to Sudbury News Talk magazine, and going with the topic, Sudbury in Former Times, I thought I would entitle my piece, Do You Remember? I was born 83 years ago in a house in Girling Street, Sudbury, opposite the car park. The car park replaced North Street Junior School, which I attended from the age of four. My earliest memory of the nursery class was having an afternoon nap on a small truckle bed covered with a scratchy grey blanket. I am sure we were glad to have a rest, even if we didn't sleep. At 5 years of age, I moved up into the junior school. Do you remember inkwells? Every morning, an ink monitor was appointed, whose job it was to go around the classroom and fill the small inkwells that were fitted in the corner of our wooden desks. We used wooden pens with metal nibs, a far cry from modern ballpoints. One unpleasant memory was the milk, which sat in small bottles in the warm classroom and was given to all school children in the 1940s. I never liked milk, and still don't, and wouldn't have it. One day, the teacher decided that she would make me drink it. Shortly afterwards, I was sick all over the classroom floor. No one ever made me drink it again. One good thing about it was that we collected the cardboard rings on top of the milk bottles to use for making woolen pom-poms. Do you remember school dinners? As our school was too small to have its own kitchen, we had to walk to a building at the top end of North Street where the dinners could be cooked. We walked sedately in a crocodile, holding hands in pairs. Sudbury Library was upstairs in the same building, so when I went to the library after school with my father, there was always a strong smell of dinner, especially cabbage. The food was fairly wholesome and plain, but that was what we were used to at home, so I don't remember anything particularly horrible about it. Do you remember Bellevue Swimming Pool? I was never a keen sportswoman, but enjoyed swimming lessons at Bellevue Outdoor Swimming Pool, except on cold days. The temperature of the water was written on a small blackboard outside the pool, and as we walked down Girling Street and round the corner into Newton Road, we couldn't wait to see what the temperature was. Anything in the 50s filled us with dread. Do you remember music lessons? At North Street School, I was in the choir, and every year we sung in the Clare Music Festival. One year we won first prize, and being the youngest member of the choir, I had the honour of being presented with the cup. We also learnt to play the recorder, which I loved, and I still have my recorder. One year we did a production of Carmen, the opera by Bizet. Most of the girls wore homemade Spanish mantillas made from combs and pieces of lace, which slipped or fell off at regular intervals. Other memories include craft lessons, where we did a lot of sewing, knitting and embroidery, including the boys. I especially enjoyed learning how to weave using small handheld looms. And who remembers the school nurse who checked our heads for nits and the dreaded school dentist? These are just a few of my memories of North Street Junior School, and I hope that the title, Do You Remember?, brings back some of your own memories.
Thank you very much, Margaret Hibble, for your memories of North Street Junior School. Very little remains of it now, except some of the exterior brickwork with the school entrances labelled boys and girls. It was lovely to hear about your school days there, and we look forward to hearing from you again. Thanks to Margaret King for reading. So here we come to our mini quiz answers. And answer number one is that Simon and Garfunkel sang Silence is Golden. We heard that from the choir next door a little earlier. Question number two. The letter B for Bertie is the first consonant of the English alphabet. Answer number three. Teddy bears were named after President Theodore Roosevelt of the United States of America. I don't really know how that came about, but I know I've read it, but I can't remember. Answer number four. The colour jaune in French is yellow, of course. And finally, in our mini quiz, answer number five. Who was known as the pelvis? I nearly gave it away there. Elvis, the pelvis, of course. Elvis Presley. So now we come to our final item, written by Toby Jacobs and read by Ken Watkins. It tells the tale of a teenage weekend with a very special lady.
Memoir. Did we ever have friends like the ones we had when we were young? These are the closing lines to one of my favourite films, Stand By Me, starring the late River Phoenix. It is the coming-of-age tale of four teenage misfits. They decide to embark on a journey through the Oregon countryside to lay claim to the body of a missing person. Beautifully shot, it captures those moments of our youth that can never be repeated, but yet stay in our minds forever. This is a similar, but less gruesome tale, of a memorable experience I had in the early 1980s. It was not uncommon for me to be standing on the platform at East Croydon Station with my school friend Luke. However, today was different. Instead of Platform 4, bound for London, we were on Platform 3, the gateway to the south. As the train pulled in, the announcer confirmed our destination, Brighton. Smoking was still permitted on trains back then, and the carriage had that unmistakable aroma of stale nicotine and old upholstery. The doors slammed shut, and familiarity slowly crept away. This was the first time I'd ventured to the coast without my parents and the safety of my dad's car. We were both 14. Luke's father was an antique dealer from Peckham, rather more Lovejoy than Nagus. He had acquired a historic racing yacht, and it was moored in the newly built Brighton Marina. This was to be our home for the next week. As Luke drew back the hatch, we were both enveloped by the smell of thyme, a mix of polished wood and brass that only age can achieve. Built in 1910, Orchis was designed by Max Ertz of Hamburg. Its sleek lines were looking rather tired, but as we lowered ourselves into the cabin, all became well. It was like an Edwardian gentleman's club on water. I had visions of us reenacting scenes from Howard's Way. I would play Charles Frere to Luke's Ken Masters, with a South London twist, obviously. We settled into a daily routine of exploring the marina and its surroundings. It still had a working boatyard with accompanying porter cabin cafe. I wonder what they made of us as we walked past, blasting out the latest tunes from our portable stereo. We were heavily into the sounds of the South Bronx, relayed to us via pirate radio and a blank cassette. The highlight of every day was our nightly walk into central Brighton. Dressed in the best of 80s fashions, we first headed for the Golden Arches for a protein fix. Then, almost hypnotised by the lights, we were lured onto the Palace Pier to pit our wits in the arcades. However, once our daily allowance was swallowed up, we embarked on our second favourite activity, to see how many times we could be ignored by the local female population. We became masters of recognising all the different nationalities of foreign exchange students, betrayed by their identical rucksack insignias, EF for French, SDS for Scandinavian. Sadly, this accrued knowledge didn't help us much. Before long, we found ourselves heading back to the boat, convinced that the next night would be different. Of course, it never was, and all too soon it was time to say goodbye to Orchis. This regal lady from a different era had looked after us well, and I've never forgotten her. Eventually the boat moved down to Poole in Dorset. I did an internet search a couple of years ago and found it being restored in a Devon boatyard. I made some inquiries, but heard nothing. I haven't seen Luke for 35 years, but I bet he hasn't forgotten me or those summer nights way back when.
Thank you, Toby. What an adventure. No wonder you have such strong memories of that time with Luke and that boat. I'm glad you looked her up and I'm glad she's still well. But wouldn't it be lovely to have another go? Thank you very much to our listeners for listening and our contributors for contributing and our technician Dave for technicianing. It's been an interesting recording today. We've had singing in the room and in the room next door. But it's a memory that will stay with me. And it just goes to show that however it's strung together and whatever the challenges can be, our volunteers, our contributors, have brilliant stories to tell. And I hope you enjoyed them as much as I did. And we'll see you next time. Bye.